This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We consider this a day to pause, to reflect, celebrate journalists and the hard work that they do every day, keeping the public informed, but also to remember the difficulties that they go through.
That's Mutoki Mumo, Sub-Saharan Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists, on the significance of World Press Freedom Day today. Details coming up. Also, a 7-day ceasefire in Sudan raises the question, what happens now? And in Rwanda, flooding and landslides from heavy rains have killed at least 109 people. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The two warring generals in Sudan agreed to a 7-day truce beginning tomorrow, according to South Sudanese officials. Mediators from South Sudan have been working with other neighboring countries to negotiate an end to the clashes, which had led more than 100,000 refugees to flee to surrounding countries in a little over 2 weeks. There's no official word. A truce has been reached by the Sudan Army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Even before the fighting began, nearly 16 million Sudanese were in desperate need of assistance. The UN's World Food Programme halted operations in the country after three of its workers were killed in mid-April. Michael Dunford, the WFP's regional director for Eastern Africa, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the group is resuming operations in parts of the country because the need is overwhelming.
WFP has lifted the suspension that was imposed immediately after the tragic loss of our three staff and five partners back on the 15th of April. We've lifted that suspension because the situation in the country is a catastrophe. We've seen the images. We know what's happening. The needs, the humanitarian needs, are increasing on a daily basis. As you said, there were already almost 16 million people who were hungry before this crisis. We estimate this number is increasing in the millions because of what's happening in Khartoum across the country today.
The UN's humanitarian affairs chief, Martin Griffiths, said the situation's reaching a breaking point. And you, too, say you're calling it catastrophic. Where are you targeting your efforts right now?
So we are immediately launching our operations. And in fact, I've just had a report from our country director. We've fed already 17,000 people in the Gedawa refugee camp today. So we're starting with existing caseloads, so refugees and others who we're needing humanitarian assistance. We will then build that out to increase new caseloads, people displaced or affected by the fighting. WFP also often will provide the backbone of the humanitarian response. So we will provide a lot of the humanitarian logistics, the emergency telecoms. We will provide the air bridge to bring humanitarians in and out of Port Sudan. And we're scaling up as quickly as we possibly can, given the circumstances.
You described some of those assistance kind of operations that you're doing. I want to know more about how that looks on the ground. What other kind of assistance are you providing?
Well, at the moment, we're providing basic food assistance because we already had stocks in country. We have actually had some of our stocks, almost 17,000 metric tons, looted since the crisis started, but we still have the capacity to feed millions of people, and that's what we're aiming to achieve. We will work initially in the east and the south of the country. Obviously, you understand that the situation in the Darfurs and Khartoum is very unstable, very dangerous at present. But our aim is to take a phased approach and gradually build out our operation as we build up our capacity, and particularly the ability to operate in these highly insecure areas.
What about the people in Khartoum? Are you planning anything to try to reach them or them to reach you?
Ultimately, yes. But as you've seen, there's heavy fighting. There's even suggestions that the RSF may have taken the presidential palace today. So it's a very volatile, very fluid situation.
That's Michael Dunford, the WFP's regional director for Eastern Africa. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. A group of Sudanese protested the UN as the world's body relief chief Martin Griffiths arrived Wednesday in the city of Port Sudan. The city has seen an influx of Sudanese and foreign nationals fleeing fighting between the military and the paramilitary force. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan on the latest developments.
The United Nations Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths, says he is in Sudan to reaffirm the commitment of the UN to support the Sudanese people. Speaking Wednesday shortly after meeting Red Sea State Acting Governor Fath Allah Al-Haj, Griffiths expressed the urgent need to deliver humanitarian aid to the people affected by the fighting in all parts of the country. He also stressed the need for security assurance for humanitarian aid workers who will be engaged in the operations in the coming days.
Humanitarian aid needs to move, most of it through Port Sudan, closest to the places of need and people in need, whether that's in Khartoum or in Darfur or elsewhere. We need to move forward, and we need to move our own humanitarian workers with that to make that happen.
Griffiths confirmed to the press that upon his arrival, he had a phone conversation with Sudan's army leader Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, who assured him of cooperation. Griffiths says he will be making efforts in coming days to meet representatives of both the armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces to ensure that an immediate ceasefire is upheld and allow the smooth movement of humanitarian operations. The two sides are locked in a power struggle.
We are seeking to meet representatives of the rapid support forces as well as, of course, of the Sudan armed forces to make sure that we have a conversation which clarifies our needs and our accountability, and we want that to happen.
Port Sudan citizens chanting "One Army, One People" during today's protest that coincided with the arrival of Griffiths. Not everyone is welcoming the UN presence in Sudan. Protesters demanded that head of the UN mission in Sudan, Volker Perthes, leave the country immediately. The demonstrators, who gathered at the military headquarters in Port Sudan, accused Perthes of fueling conflict in Sudan. Speaking on behalf of protesters, Muhammad Hassan, the paramount chief of the Beni Amir tribe, Port Sudan, demanded Perthes leave the state within 72 hours. Hassan says, "We don't have any personal issue with him, but we are anxious for the future of this country. Whenever he goes, there is nothing good that he leaves behind. We are here demanding that this man should leave this state alongside all his supporters." Hassan and other protesters reassured the military of their full support to end the war in Sudan. Port Sudan's military commander, Major General Muhammad Osman, said he appreciated the efforts of the Port Sudan citizens who chose to live in peace with one another. Griffiths is expected to be in Port Sudan for a couple of days to engage Sudanese warring parties, civil societies, and civilian leaders to ensure that people in need receive humanitarian aid. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
The power struggle between Sudan's de facto leader, Army Chief Abdel Fattah Burhan, and his former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who commands the powerful Rapid Support Forces, RSF, paramilitary, is well into its third week. Both sides had claimed control of most of the capital, Khartoum, but in an exclusive interview with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi, former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., Kadir Haroun, detailed his personal account of the situation in Khartoum before he took refuge in Djibouti on his way back to Washington.
Khartoum itself, it is composed of three towns. Khartoum proper, which is situated between two tributaries of the Nile River, the Blue Nile and the White Nile. Across the Blue Nile north, we have Khartoum north, and on your left side, across the White Nile, we have Omdurman town. Three of them composed the greater Khartoum. I live in an area, circumference is about 3 kilometers, which includes the presidential palace, the general command of the Sudanese army, and the Khartoum International Airport. So this area is controlled by the RSF. This is controlled not because they stormed these strategic places, but because they were there from the beginning. This area for some time is secured by units from the Sudanese army jointly with the RSF. So that is why it's easy for them to control it. They took their colleagues from the Sudan armed forces by surprise and controlled this area and take them as hostage until now. We stayed there for very difficult 5 days without running water, without electricity, without food, and we are forced to leave the area. So we took refuge in southern part of Khartoum, a place called Kalakla. On our way to that place, we've been shot by rifles, and we stopped. We discovered that the fans of the engines, as well as radiators, partially damaged. After some argument with them, they let us go about 25 kilometers south to Khartoum. We took refuge with a relative there for other 5 days. So when we decided again to lift ourselves and to go out Khartoum altogether, we drove from this place in southern Khartoum all the way to the northern part of Omdurman city. So we went there, we met many times by checkpoints controlled by the Sudanese armed forces. And then in the central Omdurman, we stopped by checkpoint controlled by the RSF. They searched us and they let us go. After that, we never came across any checkpoint controlled by RSF till we reached Wadi Sayedna Air Force, where we been lifted to Djibouti, to Nairobi, and from there we took our way by ourselves. The RSF are in this area, 3 kilometers, the diameter, and they have some pockets in some other Khartoum north, some this specific area, very close to central Omdurman. So this is will lead me to conclude that most likely the upper hand is the Sudanese armed forces, the army, controlling most of the part of the Khartoum area. So the Sudan itself as a federal government has 18 federal states, 17 federal states. There's no problem. There is no war there. So there is no way to describe the situation as civil war.
Mr. Ambassador, the Rapid Support Force Chief Mohammed Hamdan Daglo said our problem is with the military leadership, but General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan told Al-Hurra channel that he offered Hamdan Daglo that both of them should be resigning from the leadership of the Sudanese military and the Rapid Support Force and let others take over. But Hamiti refused to leave and he told Al-Burhan, "You go, I want to stay and will not go." What do you make of that?
I don't buy this kind of statements, frankly, because we had 2 or 3 revolutions against military rule back in 1964 against General Ibrahim Aboud. And in 1985, we had an uprising against President Jafar Nimeiri. And usually the army will take responsibility for 1 or 2 years. In both cases, it was 1 year, and after 1964, it was just about 3 months. The army under President Abdurrahman Suwar al-Dahab arranged an election without interference of any regional or international power. It was very successful. So I think to get out of this hole, the army has responsible, according to the constitution, to hold an election and to allow people to get rid of Burhan himself and Hamiti and allow the Sudanese people the elected civilian government, which really has the mandate of the people of Sudan.
That was former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., Kadir Haroun, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. German troops have started to withdraw from Mali as Berlin aims to wind up its mission, hampered by disputes with the ruling military junta in Bamako and the arrival of Russian forces. According to Reuters News, Berlin has deployed some 1,000 troops to Mali, mostly the northern town of Gao, where their main task is to gather reconnaissance for the UN peacekeeping mission, MINUSMA. The military has begun shipping the first components of what amounts to some 1,300 container loads of equipment, the German commander in Mali, Colonel Heiko Boschak, told the daily Tagesspiegel in an interview published today. Also, on Wednesday, the government in Berlin paved the way for a last one-year extension of the decade-old mission until May 2024, a decision subject to approval by the lower house of parliament. In recent months, there have been repeated instances of friction between the Malian authorities and MINUSMA. Europe's relations with Mali have deteriorated since a military coup in 2020 and since the government invited fighters from the Wagner Group, a Kremlin-linked private military company, to support its fight against insurgents. France withdrew its troops in 2022. Today is World Press Freedom Day. In the second part of my conversation with Mutoki Mumo, Sub-Saharan Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists, she talked about physical attacks on journalists, calling it an extreme form of oppression. She says such attacks usually happen around election time, a period when tensions are at their highest.
We have two, unfortunately, prime examples of that, just looking at the last few months. In Nigeria, during the elections in February and again in March, we as CPJ documented numerous instances where journalists were physically attacked, where journalists were harassed, briefly detained. And in Kenya, which is where I am based, during protests in March, we saw journalists reporting that they were harassed, that they were assaulted. And we as CPJ have for a long time spoken about a hostile environment for journalists, where in countries like Somalia, where death is a very real possibility when you report the news in a certain way, because you face the risk of being targeted, particularly by the Al-Shabaab militants. But if we look at 2023, it is also a year that started on a very sour, on a very difficult note for the African media community, because in January and February, we recorded the deaths of three very prominent journalists in this region, one of them being Cameroonian Martinez Zogo, who went missing and his body was later found mutilated. And then we can also talk about the Cameroonian Jean-Jacques Lababe, who was also a priest known to be critical, known to speak critically on subjects such as corruption, who was also killed in February. And we could talk about the Rwandan John Williams Mutwali, who died in January or in a traffic accident, which we as CPJ and other organizations have deemed as suspicious and have asked Rwandan authorities to provide more information about. So broadly speaking, we can see trends such as imprisonment. We can see trends such as the use of laws to criminalize speech online. And we can also talk about physical attacks, sometimes which can become fatal for journalists.
Mutoki, how can an organization like the CPJ combat this modus operandi by African governments who have embraced lately to prolong their time in power, imposing states of emergency, shutting down the internet, cracking down on critical voices and on independent media? How do you combat that? Reporting is enough?
What can organizations and institutions do? I know you said is reporting enough, and my answer is sort of Yes, because stories must be told and stories are inherently powerful in themselves. And when we forget or we do not give voice to those who have been oppressed, those journalists whose safety has been compromised, there's a power that we're giving up in that. When we do not tell the stories, we do not document what happened to Martinez Zogo, for instance, or John Williams Mutwali, or the Ethiopian journalist Dawit Kebede Araya. When we don't tell those stories, there's power that has been lost. So reporting for me is essential, because reporting and documentation is the first step towards justice. It's the first step towards accountability, and it's also a step towards change. Now, what more can be done? We use reporting, speaking as CPJ, as the basis on which we continuously engage, continuously push governments for change. And this is African governments, but it is also their diplomatic partners to make sure that in all fora we are asking questions around press freedom when nations are signing deals between themselves, when they're coming to agreements. We ask, has human rights been considered? Has press freedom been considered? When telecommunication companies are expanding, moving to new countries, investing, we ask, have you considered what human rights looks like when you go to this new country? And what measures will you put in place to make sure that your tools, that your company is not used to silence the public through things like internet shutdown, as an example? So reporting is the basis for ongoing dialogue, for continuous dialogue with governments themselves, with their partners, and also within fora such as the UN system or the African Union system. And it is also the basis in some cases on which we can pursue things like strategic litigation, whether that's at the East African Court or at the court in West Africa, the ECOWAS Court. So again, just to emphasize that reporting is really, really key.
That was Mutoki Mumo, Sub-Saharan Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists on the occasion of World Press Freedom Day. She talked to me from Nairobi, Kenya. Police in Zambia have surrounded the home of former President Edgar Lungu and are demanding they search it as part of a corruption probe. Kathy Short reports from Lusaka.
A spokesman for Zambia's former ruling Patriotic Front Party, Rafael Nakachinda, told VOA that police forcefully gained access to the Lusaka home of the former president.
It is not only unconstitutional, but criminal. This government never to respect not even the supreme law of the land, which is the constitution, which confers the former president with immunity.
Zambian police spokesperson Dan Mwale told VOA Wednesday afternoon that police were still outside the property.
Okay, police officers are at the former head of state resident in Ibex in Lusaka. Yes, currently we can't give out a statement as to why they have surrounded the house. We'll be able to issue a comprehensive statement as soon as we are done with why officers have gone there for. Thank you very much.
The police action comes 10 months after Zambia's anti-money laundering agency summoned former First Lady Esther Lungu over the ownership of 15 luxury flats in Lusaka. Investigators said they believed the apartments were ill-gotten gains. The Lungus denied wrongdoing, according to the Patriotic Front Party spokesman. No charges were filed, and Lungu's lawyer told journalists the matter was closed. Critics say a government campaign against corruption is being used to target and intimidate political opponents. Numerous officials who served under former President Lungu have been arrested and his family members questioned. Current President Hakainde Hichilema has denied allegations that his fight against corruption is targeting opponents. Lungu's party was defeated by Hichilema and his United Party for National Development nearly 2 years ago. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1 202-258-3076.